This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We hoped to be in Santa Clarita under better circumstances, but today it's a school shooting.
We heard all my friends were around. We heard the first gunshot and we all thought it was a balloon popping, but it was too loud for a balloon to pop. And then they went 1, 2, and then we all just started running and people were falling in front of me. And I ran to across the street to someone's house and stayed there till my parents picked me up.
That's Saugus High School student Brooklyn Moreno, who just after 7:30 this morning took cover to protect herself and her friends. She was speaking there with KABC TV Channel 7. Two students have died, a 14-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl, and several other students were injured in today's shooting at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita. Joining us now, right now, is Steve Kuz. He's a reporter for KTLA Channel 5 and a friend. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, hi there, Mr. Chiotakis. It's great to be here with you today.
I mean, my goodness.
Better circumstances, you're right.
So what do we know right now? Police, sheriff's officials say that the suspect is in custody, right?
Yeah, well, he's not just in custody. He unfortunately is in the hospital. This sounds like it was a murder-suicide of sorts. From what we've been piecing together so far, you know, the school day was just starting over at Saugus High School. It was about 7:38 this morning, and all of a sudden, as we heard from one of the students there, these gunshots, these pops, just started going off across campus. We were told this was taking place in the quad area, so you got a couple dozen students all gathered around in this group when, according to LA County Sheriff's deputies, a student, a 16-year-old, who's just was celebrating his birthday today, pulls a gun from a backpack, 45 caliber semi-automatic handgun, and just opens fire on those people standing around him. A number of girls were hit, two boys, and as we've now learned, one of those girls, a 16-year-old, has died, as well as a 14-year-old boy. What happened next after this young man, the 16-year-old, shot five of his classmates? Officials say he turned the gun on himself, put it to his head, pulled the trigger, and tried to take his own life. As of last check, the shooter is in grave condition in the hospital being treated. And you know, also another thing interesting here, the bullet he fired on himself, that was the last bullet he had in his chamber of his gun. You know, we don't know if it was planned out or it was just a coincidence that he, you know, fired every single round he had in his gun before saving the last one for himself. But that's how it played out here. In a situation like this, you know, everyone always says, if only there could have been, you know, someone on the scene with a gun, right? It could only have been, you know, sheriff's deputies right there. Well, in this case, we're told the sheriff's department was on the scene at the school in about under 2 minutes. So they got there, you know, by 7:40, their officers were on the scene, running through the school halls, going through an active shooter situation. They get into the quad area, and that's where they find everybody that was wounded. You know, we are hearing reports from other students saying that, you know, some of the people who were less injured were able to, you know, crawl away or run away in some situations to classrooms where other classmates just tried to help them stop the bleeding that was going on from their gunshot wounds. So now all of them have been, you know, taken to various hospitals throughout the Santa Clarita Valley area and are being treated right now. And as for the shooter, authorities aren't releasing his name yet, but, you know, this is a high school, so kids know who this guy was. They say he was, you know, well-liked, pretty popular. He had a girlfriend. You know, he just turned 16 years old today. This, again, was his birthday that he decided for whatever reason to carry out the shooting. And in a lot of these cases, people say, you know, there was something that was missed. There was a sign, right? There had been signs. From everything we've seen so far, this took a lot of people by surprise. You know, nobody was ready for this. From what we've heard on the scene from neighbors who knew this kid, who he was, you know, they say apparently his father had passed away about a year ago, and it was just him and his mother now in their home, and they may have been, you know, struggling through some family matters, as I guess any family would after, you know, losing a parent like that. But, you know, yeah. From the outside, nobody really knew that, you know, something was going on here. This kid obviously was going through a really difficult time, and, you know, I'm sure we'll probably learn more in the coming days. In the meantime, the very latest we know right now is the LA County Sheriff's Department has obtained a search warrant to go into this young gunman's home and try to find more evidence and hopefully a motive, maybe a manifesto or potentially even a note he left behind, Steve.
KTLA reporter Steve Kuz, reporting from the scene in Santa Clarita. Steve, thank you so much. We appreciate you taking time out for us.
Thank you, Steve.
Cindy Kleinfeld is the mother of three seniors at Saugus High School. And Cindy, I'm so sorry to be talking with you on such a terrible day. How is it going right now for you?
It's calmed down, you know, the adrenaline rush of this morning, and now we're all just settling in at home.
Will you tell us how you experienced things this morning? I mean, there are a lot of folks who just can't even imagine.
My kids have a first period, so it starts just before 7 o'clock. So they were all three at school. A coworker and another parent at the school called me, and she was hysterical, and she said, there's an active shooter at school. And that's all I got. And then I rushed out the door. I live about a mile and a half from school. As soon as I opened my front door, I could hear the sirens. So I knew the area, so I knew school would be impacted. So I stopped at the Albertsons, which is a block away, and then just took it by foot. But as I was going toward the school, kids were running toward Albertsons just crying.
Did you have communication with your children during this time? Did they have phones with them?
They all three have phones, and I hadn't gotten word yet. The first text I got, my daughter created a group chat and said, we're on lockdown, and that's all I knew. But I had already knew that there was an active shooter. And then I had to wait another 20 minutes or so to have my two boys also say that they were safe.
Have you been with your children as of today, as of right now?
Oh, yes. So yeah. The pickup was a mess. They had to walk to the bus, then they had to wait for all the kids to get on the bus, and then they had to go to Central Park, then they had to be interviewed, and then they could be released. And so it was a madhouse, because like every other parent, we all wanted to see and touch our kids and know that they were okay.
Right, see and touch your kids. And I ask you that question because in my mind, I want to know exactly what is going through your mind as a frantic parent who's trying to figure out what is going on. What is happening to you when you get this first notion of what's happening at the school?
Pure panic, because I have three, you know. My odds of being one of the parents are higher because I have more kids there. But luckily they were safe in class, and this happened outside of the classrooms. But yeah, I don't know what I would have done. And I wouldn't have been in complete panic if I had not heard from them. You know, I don't know how parents did it, because some kids don't even have cell phones. So they had no way to communicate with their parents. And I stood out for hours waiting for them to start to release the kids. But once I got there, after a few minutes, I noticed the police were all fleeing. So I assumed that they were after the suspect. But as you know, he never left.
He never left because, as the reporting goes, he pulled the gun on himself and is gravely wounded from trying to take his own life. Have your kids, Cindy, been through active shooter drills? Have they prepared for something like this?
Yes, they have. They've done it on multiple occasions. And when my son was sitting in class, the door was open. And one of the classmates said, we've got to lock the door. And the teacher just sprang, didn't ask any questions because they hadn't got the alert yet. Teacher stood at the door, held it until one of the kids could bring him his keys and lock it, and they turned out the lights and they just laid low until they got the all clear.
Do you or your kids know the student who's thought to be the shooter? Again, I mean, we got the report from Steve Coos just a moment ago that he's a pretty popular kid. He didn't seem like there was anything going on there.
My kids, one plays soccer, but this particular student was on cross country, so obviously a lot of kids know him. But my kids are seniors, and he's not. So the one of the victims, my son knows, but other than that, my kids had no relationship with him.
How you doing right now?
I'm a little shaken up. The phone was ringing off the hook. Everybody from out of state are calling. Is this your kid's school? And watching the parents all cry, you know, my kids have gone through this school district with the same students from elementary school. So we know a lot of the families. And it's really tough because, you know, of course, you pray it never happens at your school. And it was hard watching everybody, watching the kids run past you crying and just scared.
Are there any plans to memorialize the people, the students who died? I understand there's a vigil coming up, right? Perhaps this weekend?
Well, I heard two things. Yeah. One is going to be at Grace Baptist tonight. It's a prayer night. But my daughter told me that there's going to be one on Sunday.
Yeah, that's what we're getting as well, that there's going to be a vigil on Sunday that we'll keep up with and check back in with you guys to find out how things are going. I do want to thank you on such a horrible, frantic day. We're so sorry that you and the school community are having to go through this, but thank you for sharing your story with us today. Cindy Kleinfeld.
Thank you. Bye.
Cindy Kleinfeld, mother of three seniors at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita, where there was a school shooting earlier this morning, happened just about 7:30 this morning, I guess before first bell. Two students died, one 14 years old, another 16 years old. Three others, plus the shooter, are being treated for their injuries as well. We'll continue to update this story, of course, throughout the afternoon, right here on KCRW. Well, coming up, the golden visa can be yours for a load of money. How you can buy some immigration if you invest and create some jobs. It's Greater LA on KCRW. Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. And now to a special kind of immigration that has to do specifically with real estate. And I'm joined now by KCRW reporter Anna Scott, who's out in downtown L.A. at the moment in the heart of the city's sports and entertainment district. Hi, Anna.
Hey, yeah. So I'm right across the street from L.A. Live, surrounded here by tall buildings right underneath a digital billboard. It's a very good place to talk about real estate development.
Well, yeah, and that's indeed what we're talking about today, real estate development and something known, you told me this off air, something called a golden visa. Anna, what is a golden visa?
Yeah, well, okay, I'm going to set the scene here for you, which will then help explain what that is. But picture that you're standing here with me for a minute. You're standing right in front of a hotel. It's a modern-looking, sleek, beige hotel, 20-something stories. It opened about 5 years ago. Now, one thing that you can't see just standing here is the big pool of investors who paid to build this hotel. But there were about 360 of them, all from countries outside the U.S. This is one of dozens of projects here in L.A., and there are many more around the country, that was financed through something called the EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program. It's been around for a while, about 3 decades, and every year it provides green cards to a limited number of foreigners who invest at least $500,000 in some kind of American venture.
$500,000. That's like $500,000. So basically you're buying a green card.
Well, yes. They do call it the golden visa, but it's not in exchange for nothing. The idea with it is to trade foreign capital for American jobs. So the investments have to go into projects that are expected to create a certain number of jobs, at least 10 jobs. So the idea is to stimulate the economy, create jobs, and create a win-win kind of a situation.
Does it have to be a real estate development, though? Do these folks have to, like, invest in a hotel in downtown L.A.?
No, they don't. It can really be almost anything, that as long as it meets that job threshold. But real estate is where most of the money ends up. Partly that's because it's familiar and seems somewhat safe to a lot of investors. And partly because real estate developers have courted EB-5 investors, especially since 2008, when a lot of traditional bank financing dried up.
All right. So why are we talking about EB-5 now? Are there changes coming to it?
Oh, how did you guess? Yes, the EB-5 program is about to change. In 1 week, the federal agency that oversees it, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, plans to raise the minimum investment from $500,000 to $900,000.
Wow, that's a big increase. That's almost doubling it, right?
Yeah, it's about an 80% increase. And even for a program that favors the wealthy, that's a big difference.
I'm well aware that I'm from a family that has more resources than most.
Ishan Khanna is 26 years old and originally from New Delhi. He became an EB-5 investor a few years ago.
So both my parents are educated in the United States. My mom now does college counseling for kids who want to get into colleges all around the world. My father owns an IT business. You know, both of them knew the value of the U.S. education, but they ended up coming back to India.
Khanna came here for college too, to Loyola Marymount University in LA. He decided to stay in the States after graduation.
I looked at all my different options. I actually sat down with my would-be later on immigration attorneys and, you know, looked at all the different options that I had.
including various types of work visas, but he worried about what would happen if he got laid off or seriously sick. He liked that EB-5 offered the security of permanent residency.
So I'm lucky that a lot of the money that I used for my investment came from my parents.
With their help, Canna invested in building a new Four Seasons hotel in Puerto Rico. And he learned so much about EB-5 in the process, he now works finding other Indian investors for the company that helped put his deal together. But he himself probably couldn't have afforded the new $900,000 minimum.
I have a younger sister. She studied in the U.S. as well. My parents had to quite literally choose which child to do it for. I'm sure if they had the ability to do it for both, they would have done it then and there.
I think we'll still see a fair number of people willing to put that money down.
Stephen Yale Lair teaches immigration law at Cornell University. He predicts in the long run there will always be demand for this kind of visa. But in the short term, the new higher cost could lead more foreign investors to turn away from the U.S. to other countries with similar programs.
Obviously, countries like to see money coming in if it's going to create jobs, and so the United States is competing with these other countries.
The reason for the increase is pretty dry. It's an adjustment for inflation, but it's part of a bigger effort to modernize and overhaul the EB-5 program. To that end, it's not the only change taking effect this month. On top of the new cost, the federal government also plans to start exercising more oversight of projects soliciting investments. That's partly to prevent would-be investors from getting swindled into bogus deals, which has been a problem in the past. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, is one lawmaker who's pushed to reform the program.
It's cracking down on corruption, and it's also ensuring investments go to places that need them the most.
When Senator Grassley says places that need investment most, he's referring to the fact that EB-5 was originally designed to help the economies of rural and high unemployment areas. In fact, those who invest outside those places are technically supposed to pay a higher minimum, $1 million under the current rules.
But pretty much no one does a $1 million deal, because why would you pay twice as much for something you can get for half off?
Brad Stedham is president of EB-5 United, a company that manages financing for deals funded through the program, the same one Ishan Khanna works for. Until now, the federal government has allowed so much latitude in defining high unemployment areas, even developments in upscale parts of Los Angeles or in Manhattan can qualify. The new rules tighten up those standards. And that could make projects in booming urban centers less appealing. Stedham says that more than other kinds of investors, people in EB-5 are reluctant to pay more than they absolutely have to because their main goal isn't to turn a profit.
We say an EB-5 investor wants five things. They want a green card, they want a green card, they want a green card, then they want their money back, and then if I get some return, great.
That's KCRW's Anna Scott reporting. And Anna, by the way, is connected with us once again in downtown Los Angeles. Where are you now, Anna?
Well, I am now standing in front of the Metropolis Project. This is the huge project that you can see from the 110 freeway. I'm standing between three big towers with luxury condos and a hotel inside.
The Metropolis Towers, I think I've seen those on the side of the 110. Is that another project that's partly funded through EB-5?
Well, you got it. Yes, yes. This project was by the developer Greenland, which is primarily based in China, and relied on a lot of Chinese investment, actually, for its EB-5 program. And the new rules are coming this month. Things are going to get more expensive. They're going to crack down on where you can pay that lower minimum amount. We will see how that impacts projects, you know, like this in booming urban centers. But for now, the EB-5 program remains really popular because investors have lined up in recent months to enroll before those new rules kick in.
All right. KCRW reporter Anna Scott reporting today from downtown Los Angeles. Anna, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Distilleries are places that make alcohol and spirits on site. It's not a winery, it's not a brewery, it's a distillery, as in it distills spirits such as whiskey, brandy, rum. You get the idea. And when you visit, some distilleries, you know, the ones with tasting rooms, are allowed to serve you 1.5 ounces per day. But for private events, that limit is waived. Regulating and abiding by that isn't so black and white, and recently a bar in Orange County called the Blinking Owl got caught up in a web of complications over the state licensing for distilleries, and now the Blinking Owl has been forced to shut down temporarily. Mona Holmes has been watching this story. She's a reporter at Eater LA, one of our regulars here at Greater LA, our mixologist, as it were. Hello, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
1.5 ounces of alcohol. Can we distill that? Pardon me, for listeners. I mean, is that like one shot? How much alcohol really is that? It's like a jigger, right?
It is 3 tablespoons.
Yeah.
Believe okay. it. Just imagine taking in 3 tablespoons of whiskey, scotch, bourbon.
Now, distilleries are not bars. These are places that distill the alcohol, the spirits, as it were, and then they have these tasting rooms, right?
They do.
All right. And they have to have a special license for that.
They do. It's called a Type 74 Craft Distiller's License. So the fine print is just designed to distinguish between bars and distilleries. At a bar, you can go in, you can order a drink. There's no limitation to what you can order. But at a distillery, they want to make sure that people don't get a little too slosh. They're not licensed for that. So people can come in and have one taste, 1.5 ounces per person per day. But there's a little tiny fine print in there too. That is waived during private events where people can actually come in and have as much as they want.
Let's talk about the Blinking Owl. I mean, this is the bar that's being shut down temporarily. They had a couple of separate occasions where they violated these regulations.
They did.
Walk us through what happened there. The first one happened a few years ago, right?
They did. It happened in 2017. And the owners, Robin and Brian Christensen, they know that their first violation was a mistake. It was an accident. This happened during a private gathering. Robin Christensen invited a patron over that they thought was a regular, and it turned out to be an undercover ABC agent. And she was hanging out with friends and said, come on over, let's have a drink. And then they wound up getting cited for that, and it wound up resulting in a $3,000 fine. And then the second one happened over a year later in 2018. An undercover ABC officer registered himself and a second person to be a private guest at Blinking Owl, and that meant that they could drink a little bit more than the 1.5 ounces.
But there's still a limit, right?
There is still a limit, and that is still a little bit unclear, actually.
Really?
But here's what Blinking Owl and some other distilleries decided to do. They decided to implement their own system to make sure that they didn't violate the law, and so Blinking Owl wound up giving out wristbands to people who registered as private guests and helped distinguish from those that were just coming in to get that 1.5 ounce shot. And during the visit, another couple entered the tasting room without wristbands and sat next to the undercover officers. The undercover officers consumed 2 drinks and left, and they didn't contact the Christensens until a couple of months later.
So they're shut down temporarily, 25 mm-hmm. days. But
correct.
Every day that they're not open, they're not making any money.
Correct.
Right? So that's a big deal.
They'll lose thousands in revenue,
yeah.
Especially around the holiday season.
I know you reached out to ABC to find out what they're saying about this. So what did they have to say?
Well, they have issue with them violating the Type 74 license. And even an administrative judge in Sacramento backed up Orange County's ABC decision. And their biggest issue is that they need to separate guests that are private and ones that are just in there for the sampling.
And not just with a wristband.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And they wanted a physical separation between the general public and private parties. And that they found that the staff's willingness to serve over the 1.5 ounce limit was a problem. And that's when they issued them the second violation and wound up suspending their license to serve for 25 days.
And they say their limits are clear, right?
That they do. Of course they do.
Yeah.
Sure.
But a little ambiguity for some of the businesses who aren't absolutely sure. Now, this is also sort of a burgeoning business, too, these distilleries that are open to the public. I mean, we've had wineries for decades, but distilleries maybe, you know, where people can go, it's not actually an old thing.
It's not an old thing, but there are businesses that don't have the Type 74 license. They opted for the Type 47 license, which allows them to serve alcohol without the limits of 1.5 ounces. So there are options for these businesses. Now, those licenses are extremely expensive. And for a business like Blinking Owl, that's small, family operated, a husband and wife team, that isn't necessarily a great option for them right now.
It seems like they're paying one way or another, aren't they?
They certainly are. Yeah.
Mona Holmes, editor at Eater LA, one of our regulars here. Mona, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's it for us. Again, we want to tell you more about what happened today. Early this morning in Santa Clarita, a school shooting that killed or left two students dead, a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, several others wounded, including the alleged shooter. You're going to hear more about it throughout the afternoon on KCRW. Thanks for being with us. Next on KCRW, it's The Bookworm. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there. Jenna Gagel, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear and for your time today. Have a great day.